Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode 66. We're recording this on, April 25th of 2019. The year is just flying by. Every week hopefully you listen every week to this very geeky conversation about all things photography. I'm your host, Don Komarechka, and we dig into whatever I can find in the news cycle that kind of piques my interest as a photo geek. And I always have somebody along in the co-pilot seat. Today, it's actually an old friend of mine that I haven't talked to in many years, new to this podcast, and I'm sorry that it's taken so long to get Derek's story on the call. Derek, how you doing?
I'm doing great today, Don. It's great to be talking geek with you.
Yeah, we've had some fun on This Week in Photo, like through the years, I think. And we've only been on, I think, maybe one or two episodes of that particular podcast together. But I've listened to your voice on many a show, both TWIP and your own podcasts. And your opinion's always been quite valuable for me. And you know how to geek out on certain topics. So you are most welcome here.
Great. Good.
So it's been quite a while since we've chatted. What kind of keeps you busy these days? I know, of course, photography is first and foremost, but everybody has their own angle to it.
Well, the thing is, these days you have to do a number of things, right? And we're actually going to talk about this in the show a little bit. But I have photo gigs going, of course. I'm a commercial photographer, so I do work for clients, but I do my podcasting. I do writing. I do social media. I do training for Linda and LinkedIn. So, I mean, it's, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And at the end of the month, you hope it all adds up, right?
Yeah. You know what? You got to wear so many hats today. Yeah, it's not like the days are far gone where you could say, oh, you know what? I'm a photographer for, I don't know, the New York Times or whatever.
Exactly.
And there might be three people in the world that can say that. But the average photographer has to diversify, I think. And you know, you mentioned you do a lot of courses and podcasting. I think that mentorship and being able to teach other photographers has been a growing and somewhat liberating part of my job, where I'm thrilled I don't have to keep any secrets. You know, like I tell everybody everything, how I do it, and that doesn't jeopardize my work in any way anymore.
I totally agree. I do physical workshops also, and it's the same thing. And, you know, the thing is, I could tell someone exactly how I do something, and they're going to take bits and bobs from that, and then they're going to do it their own way anyway. So it's not like that someone's going to go out and shoot the photo exactly the same way I'm going to. They don't want to. They want to put their own stamp on it.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I'm known for a lot of my work on a small scale for macro photography. And even if you did teach somebody exactly how to take the exact same photograph that you did, they're going to take that same flower and they're going to see it from a different angle. They're going to light it in a different way. Maybe a bug's going to fly by and it's all of a sudden an entirely different narrative just from one second to the next. So, photography education, I think, is a very valuable component of, if you look at all the pieces of the pie for me. I think that's not the biggest one, but it's definitely a growing component of it. And if people have been listening to the podcast, I do workshops too. I've got one coming up in Iceland later this year, which I'm really thrilled about. Still a few spots left on that, and I need to fill, I think, two more spots up for it to be green-lighted. So if anybody's curious, go check that out. But let's kind of segue into the stories here, because one of the things that I get in my inbox quite often is, you know, people might be commenting on a photo that I've posted, and I give as many details as I can about how I shot it and the equipment that was necessary to do that. But a lot of times when I'm like even doing a physical exhibition somewhere, people come up to me and says, "Oh wow, what camera do you have?" And it's one of the most annoying questions that I've ever encountered. And yeah, sometimes I'll tell them, but it really doesn't matter for that end. I've used so many cameras over the years. But it's kind of a rough segue into our first story, because every camera manufacturer is going to be coming out with new equipment all the time. And whatever camera you have is probably an excellent, exceptional one, no matter how old or vintage it might be. It's better than the antiques of my father's generation and my grandfather's generation that took award-winning, world-changing images. But we're always looking at that next great thing and always hunting through the rumor websites to find what that might be. There's a leak It's been around, DP Review doesn't usually report a lot of rumor mill type material. So it was interesting to see this on their front page that Canon has a 63 megapixel full frame sensor in the works. And the title says possibly for a high resolution EOS R camera. When we dig into that a little bit, I might think otherwise. But I want to pass this to you, Derek, because resolution isn't necessarily everything in terms of the quality of the output for your photograph. And I don't know many photographers that would need a camera even in the 50 megapixel plus range. They're coming. There's no question that Canon and Nikon and everybody else, we're going to have like 100 megapixel cameras before we know it. But is that where you would like the engineering efforts to go?
No, actually, you have to look at the impact on your workflow. If you have a camera that's capturing that much resolution, that many pixels, and how are you going to manage those files? So, hard drives, graphics card, all that kind of stuff. So that's a big hit to the workflow. And the question I always ask is, what do I need? What do I need to do my work? Now, I'm probably a little different than some of your listeners in that, I'm shooting events. I'm shooting stuff out in the field for clients. I shoot travel photography, journalism, all that. So I don't need 50 megapixels. In fact, I don't want 50 megapixels because
you would turn like even if your camera had the option, you'd be shooting at a lower resolution.
I would. I'm shooting at 24 most of the time, 20 or 24 depending on which camera I have, and that's giving me plenty to work with. I do want a little bit so I can crop if necessary and still maintain resolution.
But even at 24 megapixels, Derek, full HD, whatever that term means these days, it was 2 megapixels, and 4K is 8 megapixels. And so if you're talking about in terms of how people can enjoy the content, especially if you're providing a deliverable that's going to be web use or it's not going to be printed on a billboard, 24 is more than enough.
Absolutely. I have stuff that goes on billboards. And of course, you've got the whole, viewing distance thing comes into play.
Well, you're not going to nose up to a billboard and start complaining about the resolution.
No, no. You go, hey, these dots are big. No, that's not going to happen at all. So for me, 24 to 30 is really nice. I love that sweet spot. Now, there are times and there are photographers, depending on what you do, where if you had a svelte 50 megapixel capture device and you're doing advertising work or something like that, then yeah, I could see same reason why some guys shoot medium format.
Of course.
Yeah. So there's definitely going to be uses for it. What I want in a camera is dynamic range. I mean, I want a raw file that, allows me to pull out of the shadows and save those highlights and have everything in between. That is my dream. That's what I'm always looking for.
I think the number of scenarios where you're thinking, oh, I can excessively crop in to save this photograph versus, oh, if I just had better highlight recovery or shadow recovery, if I were to weigh those two into the number of times that they come up, it's definitely the latter that I want. You want the higher quality pixels. So this new sensor, I was kind of suspect about it being in a consumer-facing product because we get a lot of specifics here. And they say like on a public data sheet, it's got all these different numbers, but it's giving me things like power consumption for the chip at 0.9 watts and power supply voltage of 1.7 volts or 3.5 volts. It's giving me the fact that it comes in a 188-pin ceramic PGA. These types of specifics mean that they're going to be selling this product to somebody else that needs to integrate that into some other purpose, right? This is an industrial application, not a consumer-facing product, because all of those statistics I just rattled off would be 100% irrelevant for any consumer product, right?
Yeah, and I think that's where the disconnect is on this. They probably have it right, the source, whatever the source is, about the sensor itself. It's how you use the sensor that's probably it's probably going to be used differently than what they concluded.
Right. And Canon has shown prototypes of 250 megapixel sensors in like the APS-H size, which is now largely abandoned for non-consumer facing applications. And so I think that this is another thing within that same wheelhouse. But it's the technology, I think, underlying that will translate into additional, you know, consumer-facing products. This exact version of a sensor, probably not what you'll find in the next release from the EOS R. But I can pretty much guarantee you that there's going to be a replacement for the 5DS and 5DSR cameras. People are, even if it's not me and you, craving that higher megapixel. Mm-hmm. And even if it's just a marketing thing, those numbers will sell. If you have a few more pixels than your competitor, then you've got a sellable product there, something that you can kind of wave your banner and say, hey, look at us. We've got the biggest number here in this area. And a lot of people that are buying camera gear do so by the numbers and not necessarily by the experience and the quality. It's all a bigger is better kind of mentality that I try to get people away from, but here we are.
Well, you know, one of the things that Canon is a master at is differentiation among their products. They're really good about this. And I think one of the things that they may be looking at, and this is just speculation on my behalf, is, okay, we want to keep the DSLR going. We've got a great lens line for it, all that kind of stuff. How do we differentiate the DSLR now from this very powerful mirrorless camera line we've introduced? One of the ways that you could differentiate the DSLR is to give it a big old megapixel sensor. And you know, that to me would actually make sense and seems like something that Canon might do.
So I want to pick your brain on that thought because, you know, Canon, as you said, they have a vested interest in keeping the sales of their traditional flapping mirror products alive, right? I mean, they've done all of the R&D on the lenses and camera bodies, and now they need to sell as many of them as possible, even though they're making that transition towards mirrorless as everybody does. There's been rumors and hints that there might not be a successor to the current 7D series camera because that might be migrated towards the mirrorless platform. And so people that are looking into to purchasing equipment today, with some of these rumblings in terms of when Canon first came out with the EOS R system, there was a white paper that spelled out everything that was flawed with the EF lens mount that they really couldn't fix. And I was surprised as to how transparent they were within that document. But they basically said that we can't fix these without radically reinventing things. And so we're going to do that. And that's what we're going to push forward with. I think that that kind of message is being heard by the camera buying public. And I'd be really curious to know what their sales of camera bodies and lenses in the EF system are right now. And what do you think the future for that is going to be? Is it going to slowly fizzle out and disappear? Or is it going to be an abrupt switch that says, you know what? We'll still make all of these lenses for you. There's no question about it. But if you want anything but an entry-level beginning SLR, you're going to have to go to the mirrorless platform because all of our R&D bucks are going into those cameras.
Yeah, I mean, that is a good crystal ball question. I may be naive on this, but I don't think that DSLRs are going to have any sort of abrupt ending at all. And I do think that the market for them is going to change. And I do think it's going to become, you know, more professional and probably higher end and all that kind of stuff. But I think they're going to stay. I was an early advocate of mirrorless photography and I still shoot with DSLRs too, because there are situations and times that I just like them. I just like shooting with them and I like the lenses and all that. So I think they're going to be around, but I think we are going to see changes in that space. And, you know, the entry level stuff is probably going to move over to mirrorless.
And I'm really curious when the next professional bodies are going to come out from Canon and Nikon. I mean, Sony has their A9 in the mirrorless platform because that's pretty much the only platform that they have of merit these days. I just sold my 1DX Mark II that I had for many years. And when selling it, I looked up the shutter count on it and it was 143,000 images that I had taken with that particular camera body. It was, you know, well used by me. And that shutter has a life of, I think, 400,000 actuations. So it'll be well used by the next person. These bodies have value, but that 1DX Mark II, that flagship camera from Canon, is now multiple years old, and there's no rumblings or hints at a direct successor to that. So I'm kind of waiting to see what's going to happen here, because whenever those new cameras come out, those flagship products, right, that have all the new bells and whistles, and Olympus just came out with their OMD EM1X, which has you know, a lot of new features that we haven't seen before. Very curious to see if the old guard of camera manufacturers are going to be as innovative as the new guys.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think that even Canon has, you know, resource management issues. For instance, you mentioned Olympus and their new camera. So they put a couple cameras on hold so they could get, you know, that EM1 X out. And people are going, well, what about, you know, the EM5 Mark III? What are we ever going to see that, all that? And I think it's truly a resource issue. They can only dedicate so much time, so much energy to so many products. I think even Canon, as big as they are in that situation as well. And so we're going to see, you know, not maybe the regular cycles on the DSLR side that we're used to seeing. But I do think cameras will appear. Sometimes it may feel out of nowhere, but I think they will appear as they can work them into, you know, the roadmap.
Well, we'll see where that goes. A 63 megapixel sensor, Canon's working on it. It's probably not going to be in your next camera. But again, they have many irons in the fire. They do industrial work. They do printers and scanners and all sorts of imaging equipment that is outside of the photographer's realm. I mean, Nikon too. They've got a lot of like microscope stuff that Nikon does. Olympus, I think, does a ton of medical imaging as well. I mean, all of these companies have multiple facets of their business, and photographers are just one component of that. But it's interesting to see how that all kind of blends together, how those lines get blurred.
Exactly. And remember, before you go on the next story, this is against a backdrop of sales that are declining. Now, you know, a lot has been made about that, and I think sometimes too much. But however, it is a factor that, you know, sales are not for them now what they were 5 years ago.
Well, and maybe that means that a camera or a sensor that they develop for industrial purposes would then be an almost identical variant in a consumer product, because you only have to do that R&D cycle for that sensor once with some minor modifications for dual purposes. So we'll see. But yeah, very good point that with declining sales, because the industry is changing, people have to get a better return on their investment when they're saying, okay, sitting around a boardroom, what is the next great camera that we're going to create? How do we make sure that we make money off of it, not just now, but moving forward?
Exactly.
All right, let's move forward to the next story here. Talking about innovation is interesting, not just on the camera side of things, but also on the software side. And for a long time, after Adobe released Lightroom, and there was some competition with Aperture for a while, and of course that's gone away, but there was really no other option for sorting and doing a really quick run of your raw images that was very powerful. And so I was thrilled when a lot of smaller companies like On1 and, of course, we've got Luminar and a number of others that have been producing fairly high quality products with much more innovation on a much more rapid product cycle than we've seen from Adobe in many, many years. And so in the news this week was On1 Photo Raw 2019.5 will drop in mid-May, so in a couple of weeks from this recording. And it's got a bunch of interesting new features. Some of it you've seen in other software before, having a searchable history, which you can then go back through every step that you have done through the non-destructive editing process and pick a point in that history and revert back to that, or at least just see what path that you've come along. Nested tags, which I should mean more to me than it actually does, because I don't I don't keyword stuff, and it just gets. We were talking off the air that I'm putting together some presentations, and I'm digging through images from like 8 or 9 years ago, and of course I haven't keyworded or tagged anything of any meaningful variety. So it's been difficult to find the resources that I need back in time. And what I think is actually pretty interesting, and something that I haven't seen anybody else really embrace, is a dual screen functionality. And yes, Lightroom does have it, but it's more for showing clients images on one screen while you're, you know, moving through stuff on the other. But you can put the full browse module on one computer monitor, and I've got a double monitor layout right here, while you have the full editing suite available on a secondary display. So I find that pretty interesting, and it's all free. None of this stuff costs anything if you already have a subscription to it. Or you've bought the software for this particular 2019 product cycle. It's just a free upgrade to existing users. Now, Derek, I don't know if you've used On1. I mean, I've worked with them on a number of projects in the past, and we're partnering on some stuff later on this year that I'm very excited about, but can't talk about yet. But in my opinion, as unbiased as I can try to make it, this does look like it's a nice little bit of extra polish for just that kind of TikTok cycle. We've got major releases as a tick, and then a little bit of extra revision stuff throughout the year as a talk. What do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting, that's for sure. And to me, it seems like the door was opened when Adobe went to the subscription model for their for Lightroom and for Photoshop, which has been very, very successful for them financially, by the way. But at the same time, I think it aggravated some folks in the photography community. And I think other companies that weren't doing digital asset management, didn't have DAMs associated with their image editors, suddenly said, hey, you know, there might be an opportunity for us to broaden our user base. I think On1 definitely took a look at that. So they're kind of coming at it from a different angle. They had, you know, these really cool presets, really great looks, you know, things that you could do to make your images look fantastic. They've always been really good at that. And now, you know, they're trying to add digital asset management. So we're seeing things later on, such as nested tags and so forth, nested keywords. Well, yeah, Adobe would have had that in Lightroom right away because they were coming at it from a digital asset angle, whereas On1 is, you know, they're adding this on, trying to hold on to the people they have and hopefully broaden. And so I think it's interesting. I love it that they're doing this. I love it what Skylum is doing. And I think having these choices is a lot of fun for photographers, especially when it's affordable.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, if you want to have a one-time fee, I think they said the prices here is $99 for new users or $79 if you had a previous version and you're upgrading. Rather than, like, I pay for the full Adobe suite because I need occasionally to use Premiere or Illustrator, or, you know, I'm working on another book right now and I'm using InDesign for that. So it's kind of a necessary evil to have the whole suite. But I'm paying, like in Canadian dollars, around $80 a month just to have the privilege of using all of their software. And honestly, for the uses that I have, I don't really need to have the subscription model. I would have loved to have paid a lump sum for the bulk of this and have software that, yeah, you know what, it's 5-6 years old, doesn't really matter. I don't need the latest version of Illustrator. I can open up a vector file just fine in software that is somewhat antiquated and get my full uses out of it, where I would then keep more up to date on Lightroom and Photoshop. And of course, there's the package for that. But if I pay just like $80, just flat rate, and I get the software and I get nice updates, and I get to choose then if I want to jump on to the next version the way it used to be, you know? You mentioned how profitable the subscription model has been for Adobe, and there's no question mm-hmm. about that. If you look at their financials, it's right there in black and white. But I think that it's also disincentivized them to do the radical feature updates that they used to do when they would do a major new product cycle release, and that would encourage you to then, you know, spend more money on the Adobe software. Now they've already got you, and their only requirement is, how much do we have to do to keep you rather than get another nice big lump sum of money, lump sum of money. So when you see On1, you see Skylum, you see, you know, Capture One is another great piece of software as well that many of my colleagues use and love. Every version update has some really cool new features and more power to them. I want more of this in the industry, more choice, more variety, and more competition, I think, only helps us as photographers.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of feel like with Adobe, we've gone from exciting dating to long-term marriage model.
It's a great way to put it.
and it's great. Nothing. I love long-term marriages, but it's not as exciting as when you're dating. And I think they're fine with that. As long as the bottom line stays in good shape, they're happy with that. And the interesting thing is, and I think you touched on it, is that we still have to use their software even while we experiment with a lot of this other stuff. So for a lot of photographers, Adobe will continue to do well because they're not in an either-or situation. They go, I have to keep Lightroom and Photoshop, but I'm going to play with On1, or I'm going to play with Luminar, or Capture One. You can make the move over solid on Capture One and wean yourself from Adobe if you want, because it's pretty full featured. But generally speaking, these new software packages haven't hurt Adobe. Photographers now are just playing with more software, I think, generally speaking.
And why do we have the time to spend on all of this? I mean, it's amazing to think that, okay, I spend way too much time in front of my desk already, and now you're giving me more things to play with. But in the last version, the last major release from On One, they introduced the ability to import everything from Lightroom. Your entire catalog can get sucked right into it. And their digital asset manager, as you mentioned, has come along far enough to be able to handle all of that data, organize it in a useful way. And they are catering to those people that want to kind of cut that Adobe cord. And are they there yet? Well, for a lot of photographers, especially if you're just, you know, entering into the photographic space right now, absolutely. There's so many better options than just sticking with Adobe. For somebody that has, like I do focus stacking. On One just added support for that in their latest releases as well, but only up to 14 images. So when I'm doing a snowflake that might take me 40 or 50 images, of course, I still have to begrudgingly go back to Adobe and use Photoshop for the processing of that. But it's coming along in some very interesting ways. I'm excited. And so I just wanted to make mention that 2019.5 will be available in a couple of weeks. And if you haven't tried the software, there's a 30-day free trial. And I think most companies will offer you at least some trial system to, you know, dip your toe in the water. And don't just try On One, try everybody, because find something that works really well for you, that runs nicely on your computer, that keeps you nice and fast, especially if you're dealing with high megapixel images, as we were discussing. You know, your computer will all of a sudden feel really slow when you're going from 20 megapixels to 50 megapixels. You got to make sure the software keeps up with you.
Exactly. I totally agree with that. And it was funny, you know, we've gone from the dream of having one software that will do everything. Now we're kind of right back where we were a number of years ago, where we're using five different, you know, things to do our work. But
and, you know, I edited some images for a client recently, and, you know, I had to use a bunch of different pieces of software. A technique that I used to use years ago was I had the Nik software, Silver Effect Pro. And what I would do is I would use some of the structure sliders within that to create a nice, highly defined textured image that then I would overlay the on top of the colored image in Photoshop and change the blending mode to luminosity, and then paint it in ever so slightly in the areas where I really wanted that extra structure to be had. And I found myself digging through my archives to find my old antiquated copy of Nik software, because I didn't want to pay to have the newer one, for this one specific purpose that I had for this one specific image that required that particular treatment. And so I guess we are back in that.
We are back.
But hey, if you've got the right tools... You got the right tools at your disposal. It doesn't matter how many of them you need to get the job done, so long as it's the best job it can be. Okay, let's move on to story number three, which I don't know how much time we necessarily want to spend on, but it's a slow news week. So this one, it actually came across my radar a while ago, because I have some affinity for 3D photography, and I've enjoyed stereoscopic images for quite some time. Facebook has been dabbling in 3D for a bit. And this actually takes some techniques that, mobile photography has been using depth maps for quite some time in order to figure out how to blur backgrounds and create a more large sensor feel to photographs. But if you have a depth map for an image that basically would be white is the closest thing to the camera, and then black is the farthest thing away, and various shades of gray are different distances from the camera, you can create a kind of a 3D effect where you can, the way Facebook is implementing it here, is you can move your mouse around an image and you can see the foreground shift differently than the background with a parallax-like effect. Using some, computational photography to fill in the gaps, because you only have a two-dimensional image and you're kind of guessing how things go together, it can create something that looks like it's, you know, three-dimensional, or like it's a video where you can actually move around a little bit. Gimmicky one-trick pony, or does this have any meat to it?
I think it's one-trick pony. It's been interesting to see it crop up on sites that I moderate. And an image will come on, and it is cool. I have to say, it is cool. I do like looking at it. Everyone gets excited, a bunch of comments, you know, how did this, how do you do this, all this. And then it goes away, and then you don't see it again ever. So, it is fun to get the blood coursing there for a day or two. But I don't see it as a long-term thing.
And you look at what Lytro had done with their light field cameras, and I believe Facebook had support for them, or at least they had an API where you could plug it into your own websites, and all of that's been pulled down now. There's no further use for that. The company has been bought out by Google, I think, and largely dissolved. But the reason why I mentioned Lytro is because Red, with their Hydrogen smartphone, which is my daily driver of a phone, I love this thing, and it does some really cool 3D imagery. When they were originally announcing it and doing their pre-order run, they said that, hey, we're going to have partners with Facebook, and we're going to have support if you load up the Facebook app and you have an image that is in the H4V format that phone supports, you'll be able to see that in it's 3D. They call it 4V. Let's not get into the semantics on that, but you'll be able to see that within that application. That has not materialized yet. And I don't know if it will, based on the tepid response to the hydrogen in the market overall. I kind of put this effect into that same boat, right? Yeah. Because it's neat. It's relatively easy to execute. And it'll probably get better in time when you have more deep learning and artificial intelligence that can fill in the gaps to create better transitions between the backgrounds. I've seen some that work really well. Like in the article from DIYphotography.net that we're talking about here, but some of them just were so horribly broken, it was laughable. Like, you know, those images that I'm sure you've seen of like a panorama gone wrong with a dog that really just has his butt connected to his mid torso walking around on two legs. There has been some colossal fails from this technology in much the same way. So if you haven't tried this though, it's relatively easy to start experimenting with. So, check out some of the images that have been already posted by other people, and there'll be links to that in the show notes over at photogeekweekly.com. And let us know. I mean, I'm very curious if you've seen this and what you think about it. I don't think it'll be keeping your attention for much longer than 5 or 10 minutes,
though. Yeah, I think what will happen is that some folks will come up with some really good practical uses for it. Sites that maybe are giving you tours of really cool places, something like that. And that will be exciting, you know. And so then when it's really managed by someone who knows what they're doing and they have a concept and they're using this tool to execute that concept, that's going to be cool. In your everyday feed, probably not so much.
Yes. And just on the note of 3D photography, by the way, anybody that has been listening for a while knows that I have been trying to get a 1954 Leica Stemmar 3D lens mounted on my new Panasonic full-frame mirrorless cameras. And I had to redesign the back part of the lens because it actually enters into the camera body itself. So the septum that goes in that keeps the left and right lenses separate needs to be there. If it's not there, if I take it off, then everything just bleeds together and it's useless. The redesign was a success. So if anybody out there does have one of those lenses and wants to make it fit onto these new full-frame mirrorless cameras, just send me a note. I'll send you the 3D model, and you can have one printed out yourself. So there we go.
That's awesome.
I like to have fun and tinker and experiment. And kudos to Ian McKinnell, who is my 3D modeler, who did 3D models of snowflakes that I did into Christmas ornaments. And so I contracted him to make that piece for me, and he did a stellar job at that. All right, before we get into our next story here, Derek, I want people to find you online. And I know that you've got a couple of interesting projects on the go, including a podcast that kind of ties into the next story a little bit.
Absolutely. So two podcasts going. One has been around since 2005, The Digital Story, thedigitalstory.com. That is my weekly podcast. That's my bread and butter. I love it. Great community there. All things photography and art. But I started a new one as well, called The Nimble Photographer, in a response to, you know, watching what artists are trying to do, having to do to survive in, this economy that we're in right now, with everything changing so quickly, having to reinvent yourself so quickly. And I'm interviewing painters, musicians, photographers, writers who have been through this process of reinvention and asking them to tell their story so that we can listen to it and go, all right, maybe I can take some of that and get my thing moving forward too. So that's happening on the Nimble Photographer. Just got it started a month ago.
So the nimblephotographer.com is where we can find
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
I'm going to have to give that a listen because as you know, we're both wearing many hats. We said that at the beginning of this discussion. And sometimes I'll wake up in the morning and I'll check my inbox and my entire day does a 180 because I've got some new project or I've got some fire I need to put out somewhere. You have to be nimble. You have to be as flexible as possible. I remember when I was contracted by BBC to do some work on a documentary series, they got me to do some time-lapse of frost growing and some snowflake video stuff, and they gave me a whole shot list of interesting things. And they were filming in Norway, I believe, and they were trying to shoot some freezing soap bubbles. And they wanted to have this an important element in the documentary film. And they had some kids chasing them and everything, but they couldn't get very good footage of them freezing solid. So they asked me, Don, you know, we know you've done some stills of this particular subject. Have you ever done video? And can we see what you might be able to create for us? Because we're having a hard time getting that footage here in situ. And rightly so, you need to have not only the proper temperatures, but absolutely no wind whatsoever, and all the right puzzle pieces have to fit together. So I think a couple days later, I said just a resounding yes, let me do this. And I sent them the footage, and they said, yep, we're pretty much going to stop trying. We're just going to use yours, because it was exactly what they were after. And they used that as the title card for that documentary film.
That's so cool.
But if I wasn't but if I wasn't able to be flexible and said, you know what, I haven't done that before, I'm not sure, I just said, yeah, give me a couple days, leave it with me. And I made like 400 or 500 different attempts at it before I was finally able to get something worthwhile. It was a steep learning curve, because how do you focus on a subject with a very, very narrow depth of field that doesn't yet exist when you start rolling the camera? So, there was a documentary for Discovery Channel, and they had asked me to do some mosquito photography, of all things. That's what the documentary was about. And I had to photograph a mosquito front to back in like focus stacking to make sure that it was completely crisp and clean, and then rotate it 1 degree and do it again. Rotate it 1 degree and do it again, because this was not for stills, this was for video. And they needed to play this back as the intro to different species of mosquitoes for the film. I had no clue how to do that, but I said yes, and I figured it out along the way. I knew I had enough of the puzzle pieces to put together to make it work. So, and to hear other people with these challenges that are completely, beyond my purview of the scope of the stuff that I do, gives me creative opportunities for myself to say, hey, you know what? I never thought that I could apply that to this. And so I'm going to listen. It sounds great.
Yeah. The first guest was Trey Radcliffe, and he talks about how it all starts in school and how school messes with your mind. And he's got a nice rant on there about that. I just love. And then second one is Ben Long, who was a photography book author for years until the crash in 2008. Suddenly couldn't be a book author anymore and said, okay, now what do I do? And solve that problem. He tells that story. And the next one I have is a musician. So, I mean, this is going to be fascinating stuff. I think people will really enjoy it.
And I look forward to like hearing when you get, writers and maybe like painters and people of other visual arts on there, because again, we're all interconnected in many different ways. You know, even if you're not making a living at photography, you still have challenges every single day when you pick up your camera. So very cool.
Yep.
The nimblephotographer.com. Check that out. It'll be in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com as well. Okay. Final story. And this one kind of makes me chuckle a little bit. And it's been widely reported as well. This article I found was on F-Stoppers. Photographer listed as one of the worst jobs in the United States of America. So the study was conducted by 24/7 Wall Street. And the article says, using data from CareerCast and the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Their methodology used things like median income and future job growth as parameters to determine their rankings. And it goes on to describe exactly, the metrics and what the overall outlook is going to be moving forward for 25 different careers, at least least the 25 worst. They might have documented more than that, and they just cut it off at 25, which is where photographer comes in. It just barely makes the list at number 25. And it's kind of interesting to see this list. Derek, I know you've probably gotten a chuckle or two yourself from this story. What are your thoughts initially? And let's dive in a little bit from there.
Well, it is interesting. And, you know, what they focus on is a photographer as a job, right? And, you know, so they're saying, okay, like staff photographer jobs, you know, not a good choice right now. And that's something that anyone in the business, you know, has been well aware of for a number of years. I was actually a staff photographer in the early part of my career, two or three times. Those jobs now are gone. What they don't cover that I think is interesting is that they're saying that those jobs are now being, you know, taken away by freelancers. Well, the second part of that story is that freelancing as a photographer now is also changing and not what it was a few years ago. I used to have more clients a number of years ago as a freelancer at a higher pay rate than I do now. And so that area is shrinking also. So it's not that, you know, businesses have shifted from staff jobs to hiring contractors. They're having people out there shooting with iPhones and, you know, getting stock photography or stealing stock photography.
Oh, don't get me started.
Yeah, yeah. you know, to make up for hiring photographers. So the whole thing is really fascinating. And that doesn't make me want to be a photographer any less. That actually goes back to what we're talking about earlier. What it does make me want to do is be more creative in how I apply the skills that I've learned over the years for photography, for business, for creativity, and seeing, okay, where's the market going and how can I use the skills that I have to go there as well?
And so you mentioned, you know, the business of photography, and you have to remember, if you're making money at photography, you are a small business owner, right? You are an entrepreneur, whether it's a sole proprietorship or something else. I mean, a couple of years ago, I incorporated because it just made more sense to do that at this point. But for many, many years, it was just me trying to wrangle all of my receipts and make sure that I had them all together come tax time. And trying to justify, okay, well, if I purchase this, how is that going to make me money? You know, where is the return on that particular investment for me as a business owner? You know, and some of the early decisions I had made were, you know, buy a large format printer. I started off with a 24-inch Canon Image Prograph printer, and I loved it. It let me print like big 36 by 24 inch prints for customers whenever they would require it. I did some art shows and printed on canvas. And within about 6 months, that investment was completely paid off. And I've since gone up to a 44 inch printer. That's just a hat. You know, I'm wearing that hat as a printer. I'm wearing a different hat when I'm, I've got a company that gets me to photograph very small electrical components that normally get soldered onto circuit boards. And that's really boring work, but it doesn't pay half bad. So I'm always happy to receive a package from them and set up these little transistors or, you know, chip radios and things like that in order to get them their product. So if you look at, yes, again, that staff photographer, that's declining. And I think the numbers are actually lower in terms of a photographer with a single employer than they're listing at 49,560. That's an inflated number by the traditional sense, I think. I would say even knock a zero off of that, and it's a little bit more realistic across the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I've had... I know people have been laid off from Sports Illustrated, from major newspapers, from all of that stuff as they're cutting those staffs down. And these are publications that depend on photography. I mean, that's part of why people, you know, read them or look at them. So the staff job, I mean, anyone that's thinking about a career in photography should not be thinking about a staff job. that's the number one message. What you can be thinking about, though, is, you know, where is imaging going? Where is technology and photography as they continue to intermingle? Where is that going? And is there something interesting there that, you know, you might want to do day in and day out?
Well, and that's the key, right? You got to love what you do, especially if you're going kind of against the grain into any artistic job, right? And photography, I would consider to be one of them. You know, if you want to be a musician, you better love music. I mean, you're doing that because of your own personal passions and trying to make some money at it. And the term starving artist need apply in many of these cases. So yeah, it was funny to see some of the other jobs on the list too. You know, some of them, like welder. Well, I mean, that doesn't seem that bad. You won't take your work home with you for the most part. It is a growing career, and you make more money than photographers do in some cases. But was any of the other jobs on this list, did they jump out at you? Because I've worked some of them as well.
Yeah, I was actually focusing more on the photographer part of the list there.
So right. So, I mean, like I've worked retail sales, you know, going through college and all of that. And I mean, I can tell you that, you know, one of the big shopping days here in Canada, anyhow, is Boxing Day, the day after Christmas. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like our Black Friday. And I was working at EB Games, which is like GameStop in the US, and working there on a Boxing Day was something that I have nightmares of now. You know, there was a lineup that just wrapped right around the store, and we had to cut people off because we were at fire code limits, the number of people in the store. And we don't usually do returns on those days, but we had one lady that had bought a PC game from us. And whenever we sell a PC game, or when we did, when I was there, we would tell people, you know, check the requirements, because if your computer isn't up to these specifications, it's probably not going to run really well, and you're not going to enjoy that. And once it's open, we can't take it back. And she's waited this like 2-hour gauntlet in this lineup to return this PC game because it didn't run well on her computer. And of course, she's opened it up, and I had to tell her no. And I have never seen somebody explode like this person exploded. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're treating me like an object, not as a person at that point. And I totally get that. And so I have to just kind of kill them with kindness in a way. I have to state the policy and smile and say, okay, well, there's nothing that I can do. I call the manager over. They say exactly the same thing. This lady was so irate. For at least 10 minutes, she held up the line, at least on my cash. And it was one of the most stressful experiences I've ever had working anywhere. So much so that there was a little old lady behind her that was my next customer after we had to call mall security over to help this woman out of the store. And she handed me a $10 bill. And she said, son, go upstairs to Moxie's, which is a restaurant that was just on the upstairs of us, and buy yourself a drink. And the rest of the people around in the lineup just applauded. Yeah. And I looked at my manager and I went upstairs for a drink.
Yeah.
So that's my story of experiences of the other jobs on this list. There's many worse jobs than photographer, that's for sure.
There are, absolutely. And I think if you're looking to the future, I mean, you just want to stay away from careers that are going to be replaced by robotics. Like you don't want to go into truck driving because that's going to be automated very soon here. You don't want to go into being an Uber driver for long haul. That's going to be replaced. A lot of factory jobs are going to be replaced. So, you know, all that workforce kind of stuff is not going to be around. So, I mean, to me, that really speaks to you want to make sure you get as much education as you can. And because part of what education will help you do is look into that crystal ball of the future. And, you know, determine, you know, what has legs and what's going away.
And I was talking to somebody at my local college, and they've got a photography program at Georgian College. And they do an exit survey when people graduate, and they just ask them questions about, you know, what did you like the most, the least, et cetera, you know, those kinds of surveys. And it was kind of an interesting juxtaposition when they said the courses that they hated the most were also the ones that they found the most valuable as soon as they were able to go into the workforce. And those were the business courses. You know, being able to market yourself, being able to understand the value of your time and how you can sell yourself, because, you know, you're building a brand. Your brand is you. It's your reputation. And that's what brings you in money. And how do you associate value towards that? If anybody is a photographer out there and, you know, is looking for the next client, the next job, the next gig, take a serious look at, even if it's just an online course on marketing and advertising. I mean, that's my formal educational background, and that's the only reason why I'm able to be a professional photographer today.
Yeah, I agree. Being a business person is actually a much larger part of being a photographer than taking pictures. And, you know, and that kind of knowledge translates to, you know, different outlets as well. It's very valuable.
All right. Well said, Derek. Thank you so much for your opinions on these stories. I'm going to have you on again when it is a busier news cycle and we've got something to really sink our teeth into, but I think we did pretty well with those. Now onto the picks of the week. And I've got one that I'm surprised I hadn't picked before. It only came across my mind because I was using it earlier this week. And I don't use it often, maybe a couple of times a year, but it is a very, very helpful tool, especially when you are providing a deliverable to a client and you want to make sure that the colors are accurate, or when you're printing and you want to make sure that your print comes out accurately and not too dark, not too bright. And this would be a monitor calibration system. So full disclosure, I am technically kind of sponsored by the maker of it, X-Rite. I'm an X-Rite Colorati, and I've done some webinars and stuff for them in the past. But regardless of even the brand of calibrator that you get, you should definitely have one nearby. I've been using the i1 Display Pro for a number of years, and it's just this little tiny puck that sits on your computer monitor, and the software that comes with it will run through a good number of different colors. It knows what color it's sending to the monitor, and then it can read what color the monitor is actually putting out. And calculating the delta between those two allows you to calibrate the screen so that what you should see is much closer to it. Now, not all monitors are the same. If you're trying to calibrate a laptop display, for example, it's not going to calibrate as well as a desktop monitor, and different display technologies will calibrate better than others. But if you have any monitor whatsoever, it's probably not going to be perfectly tuned even right out of the factory. And the lighting mechanisms will change over time, and so will the exact output of the display in terms of colors. Get yourself a calibrator. This one will cost you under $300, so about $260. And you can get it in bundles with some extra hardware as well if you want to help your camera be calibrated using their Color Checker Passport. But you don't have to spend that money all yourself. And this is the key. I mentioned I might calibrate my display a couple of times a year. Well, maybe you're a part of a photo club. Maybe your photo club should invest in one. And anybody that wants to use it just as a member of the club can take it home for a day and bring it back. Or a group of photographers, if you've got a couple of friends nearby and you want to go splits on that and, you know, say, you know what, I need it this month, somebody else needs it the next month, and that's perfectly fine. You don't always need to have one on your person. So that $200-something can easily go into the single digits if you're part of a photo club and everybody pitches in, $5 to get one of these for the club. Or double digits if you got some photographer friends handy. It's a very useful tool, and don't let any price tag associated with it scare you away. I've had some students that they've come in and we've tried to do some editing on their computers in my studio here. I just had to pull it a full stop and say, you know what, we can't work on this. This is just so far out of whack. We have to just do a calibration before we take any step forward. And they were very, very thankful for that. So the i1 Display Pro is my pick of the week.
Yeah, and that's a good tip about sharing it. I love that. So,
all right. And I'm really curious what you have for us today, Derek.
Well, this is kind of a companion recommendation to the on1 story that we did. Because interestingly enough, as we record this, Skylum released Luminar 3.1. And they're doing a very similar thing in that they started out with this really amazing image editor that had a lot of new technology in it, very innovative. And then they're adding a digital asset manager to it, a browser. And so this version that came out today has had a lot of improvement, not only in the digital asset manager, things like now you can manage RAW plus JPEGs, stuff like that, much easier. They've also upped the ante on their AI sliders. And so they have one called Accent AI, Artificial Intelligence Slider, and it's a 2.0 version. And this technology is fascinating to me because basically you move one slider and a number of different things are happening to your image at once. And what AI 2.0 that's in this latest version of Luminar does is that it can identify the faces in the image so that the faces are treated different than the background, whereas 1.0, everything kind of got the same sort of treatment. And to watch the background and the faces change differently with this AI technology, I think is...
Now, what kind of changes are happening here? Like lightness and darkness, saturation? Like, do you get to choose, or is it just that one slider that does magic and then you can't really control it?
Yeah, so one slider that does magic, what you can control is intensity of it, though. So you can do a lot of it or you can do a little of it. And it's only one slider in a whole list of, 35 others, too. So you have other controls as well. But you have control over intensity, but in terms of what it's actually doing, that's artificial intelligence, that's machine learning that it's doing there. And what's kind of cool about this, as we talked about on one, is that the whole application is $60. I mean, $60, and it's a license. It's not a subscription.
And I just pulled up your website here as we were talking about the links earlier, and you can actually bring that down to $50 because you've got a coupon code for that too, don't you?
I do have a coupon code on Digital Story for it.
If you use the coupon code The Digital Story,
absolutely,
you'll get that for $50 instead of $60. And whether you're paying $50, $100, or $150 for a piece of software, because I forget exactly what Capture One is, but it's definitely more than $50.
It's $299, I think.
It's $299.
Yeah.
But regardless of where you are along that scale, if the software that you have your eye on is useful for you and it's going to be a one-time investment, I mean, I've spent so much more than any of these software packages combined on a lens, on a new piece of gear to go into my camera bag that might get used very seldomly, where the software will actually become much more useful for me in the long term. So, it's great to see that Luminar, of course, is doing those sort of TikTok updates as well with new features. And they say, at least on your website here, better sorting, better organizing. I haven't yet seen a full-on successful approach to the AI application of sorting and organizing my photographs. That's one of the things that I'm really waiting for somebody to do right. I played around with a Lightroom plugin a while back called Xire. And it used some AI algorithms to start auto-tagging things within the catalog. But it came out with 30,000 photographs of food in my catalog of 700,000 images. There's no photograph of food. I don't photograph food. So every one of them was mislabeled. And I understand that that's sort of early days in the software area. And if there's one realm of growth that we see in technology all around, it's that deep learning, that artificial intelligence, whether it's being applied to sorting and editing or directly, seamlessly when you're actually taking the picture in most smartphones. That's, I think, where the biggest growth area is. So we'll see that soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, we're still waiting for sure on that. My favorite one is when you have two eggs in a frying pan and it gets identified as a face. That correct? Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, I see what you did there. All right. Well, Derek, thank you for being on this episode of Photo Geek Weekly. Again, you can find the show notes with all of the links to the things that we discussed at photogeekweekly.com. There is also a Patreon link there, which, I have a few supporters and I don't actually update it as frequently as I should to get the coffee money that you guys so promised me. So I'll do more of that. But if you want to support the show, then we have that as an option. There's also a tip jar there if you're curious. And thank you to everybody that helps support the podcast. With a couple of dollars, it helps cover all of the hosting and production costs. I do this more as a labor of love than anything else. So thank you all for listening. Another episode has been completed. So you know what you should do is you should get out and shoot.